Autotech versus Integral Research. Mr. Barron.
May it please the Court. My name is David Barron, and I represent Integral Research and Production Corporation. This case raises important issues concerning foreign sovereign immunity and the power of the district court to impose and enforce monetary contempt sanctions. In my argument this morning, I will be stressing three points. First, that the district court below entered a writ of execution that facially violates the execution provisions of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and that was also procured with improper service.
Second, so here you're focusing on 1610?
1610, correct.
Okay.
Second, that in February 2006, the district court also imposed a judgment order that is also invalid and should be vacated because it lacks a sufficient evidentiary foundation based on clear and convincing evidence and is legally unsupportable. Third.
And on your second point, just I'll let you get the third point so you can keep it in mind. Your opponents argue that I think particularly with respect to the second point, this is really just an out-of-time appeal from the district court's original decision that the $5,000 a day was the correct accrual rate for the contempt sanction.
Correct, Your Honor. What Autotech is arguing essentially is that we are trying to take a direct appeal of the 1997 contempt order. Instead, what we are doing is making a collateral attack on the 1997 order because it has been brought forward into the 2006 order. Under this court's jurisprudence in Avishia and Inri Cat, a prior judgment is not entitled to law of the case or it is not considered dispositive on a subsequent appeal. Instead, under the collateral order doctrine, it needs to be evaluated to determine whether or not it was actually properly contested and argued. And in fact, it is the guiding law of the Seventh Circuit that a default judgment, or as the Seventh Circuit said in Inri Cat, a judgment that is the effective equivalent or the substantive equivalent of a default judgment, in other words, where the other party wasn't there, is not entitled to collateral estoppel effect. So what we have is a 2006 judgment from which we took a proper appeal that raises issues that are directly related to what happened in 1997, and this court can consider them because any decision that was made or not made by the district court, and a lot of decisions were made kind of sub silentio to the extent they were made at all, are properly before the court at this time because it's not subject to collateral estoppel protection.
But, of course, your opponents argue rather strongly that the only reason the district court proceeded as it did in 1997 is because Integral chose not to show up.
It is Integral's contention that in 1997 that it was improperly served in violation of the local rules of the Northern District of Illinois, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the service provisions of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and the Hague Convention on Diplomatic Relations.
I understand that, and here's the complexity of this case. If that had been a problem at the very beginning of the case, where the initial service of process commences the case, it seems to me these would be great arguments. They may still be great arguments, but they would certainly be straightforward arguments if it had to do with the beginning of the case, because as we know, you can't proceed with a case unless both there is underlying personal jurisdiction and service is properly accomplished. The contempt overlay puts something interesting because most other notices during a lawsuit don't need to go through all of those formalities of the initial service of process. You don't use, Rule 4 for the rest of these things. This is something in the middle where the court already has personal jurisdiction over Integral. I take it you've conceded that as to the underlying case, the commercial either waiver, the commercial activities exception, or something, it's quite clear this was a case that the court could adjudicate.
In 1996, that's correct.
Right. Well, and the case itself, the dispute about the, are you selling semiconductors outside of the distribution chain and so on. So it's the contempt that makes the question whether a brand new round of service, in the most technical sense of that term, has to happen. And what happens if it doesn't? Is this something that's waivable at this point, or is this something that's such a fundamental defect that we reach back and look at it?
There's not a lot of case law, unsurprisingly, on this point. But there is a Northern District of Illinois rule, Rule 18A, that says contempt is unique, contempt is special, contempt is important. And so when you are moving for contempt against a party, if that party has been represented in the proceeding by counsel, you need to serve counsel. Autotech didn't do that. If you're going to serve the party, you need to serve them by the means that exist in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That means Rule 4, because we're dealing with the foreign sovereign. Now we're into the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And the greater overlay that the Northern District of Illinois ruled that the provisions of Rule 18A are not just there for no reason. They're actually important, and that cases can be dismissed for failure to comply with the rules that are included in 18A, which also, by the way, just for reference, also included a requirement that there was an evidentiary affidavit, a sworn statement in support of that, and that didn't exist in this case either.
Well, there's a reference to it in the transcript, but I take it no affidavit ever actually makes it into the record. Somebody says, yes, there was service and there's an affidavit.
There is a reference in the transcript that service of process was made, not that there was an evidentiary affidavit, which is also required by 18A. All we know is that supposedly the service was made and that it was made on the embassy.
So it's your view that because this rule applies, that even though you didn't take any kind of timely appeal back in 1997 for the failure to comply with this rule, that you now are entitled to say that because this rule was not complied with, the underlying contempt order itself can't be reduced to judgment as it was?
It's one of our arguments. There's language in the Alliance case, for example, that says that the inclusion of this affidavit is what gives rise to the alleged contemnor's obligation to come into court and to confront it. Obviously, that didn't happen here. Moreover, because this violates Article 22 of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, it's a bigger kind of service. The Hague Convention, the Vienna Convention, essentially says that the premises of an embassy and the physical person of the ambassador are inviolable and cannot be subject to service.
Was he involved in the settlement?
Excuse me?
Was the ambassador directly involved in the settlement of the initial lawsuit?
We know from the record that Autotech had certain discussions with the ambassador regarding the issues. Whether or not he was involved in the negotiation of the specific terms of the settlement, I don't know. But what we do know is
he was involved to the extent that he had discussions. I mean, that's involvement, right?
Yes. Presumably so, but we know.
But he didn't sign off on the agreement.
He did not sign off on the agreement. And we know from the provisions of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act that there needs to be an actual agreement that would provide for an alternative kinds of service, and that that doesn't exist, and that no one has ever alleged that that exists.
Mr. Barron, has anybody, as this case has unfolded, proposed asking the State Department for its views on the way the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the diplomatic convention and the like should operate here?
The whole purpose of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act
I understand the purpose of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I'm asking you, in this case, has anybody asked the State Department for its views?
No one has asked the State Department officially for its views. This court, however, if it wanted to, could certainly do that by way of a letter. But we do know are what the State Department's views are on the imposition of monetary contempt sanctions. We know that as far back as 1986, in a statement of interest filed in the Von Dardel case, the Wallenberg case, that the State Department said that the imposition of monetary contempt sanctions is not permitted by the language in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and violates international practice, and that can also interfere with the ability of the United States to conduct foreign relations. Similarly, we know as well from testimony before Congress in 1986 that the State Department again expressed the view consistently that monetary contempt sanctions are not supposed to be imposed under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act or as a matter of international law and practice. And then finally, in 2006, as recently as just months ago, the State Department filed a statement of interest in a case called AFCAP v. Congo, dealing with certain obligations, in which they said that the imposition of monetary contempt sanctions should not be enforced because that violates the language of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, violates international law, and has the ability to interfere with the foreign relations of the United States.
So your opponents make an argument from the FSIA that Section 1606, extent of liability, says once you've decided that an exception to the ordinary rule of immunity applies, the foreign state, quote, shall be liable in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual. Why, in your view, does that not counteract what the State Department's been saying in these filings?
There are at least three reasons, I think. The first is that waivers of sovereign immunity under international law need to be expressed. Similarly, waivers of sovereign immunity under domestic law dealing with the domestic U.S. sovereign need to be expressed. The language that is contained in Section 1606 is exactly identical and was taken from language of the Federal Tort Claims Act. The language in the Federal Tort Claims Act, the same provision, has never been interpreted to permit monetary contempt sanctions.
So essentially you're saying it's distinguishing liability in the sense of you owe us contract damages from being subject to all manner of, you know, whatever it is, punitive damages or contempt sanctions or the like. You're reading the word liable in a narrow way.
Correct, Your Honor. The definition of liable, or the meaning of liable in this case, if this had gone to an underlying judgment, then they would have been liable as anyone else for the conduct or for the amount of that judgment. 1606 is essentially just a pass-through provision. It says substantive legal arguments coming from state law or other law can be applied once immunity is found, and then liability is going to apply.
But you know what's troublesome about that proposition? Once you have gotten past the immunity determination again, and you have a case that's now going forward in court. The example I always like to use is, you know, suppose Air France doesn't pay the people who clean their airplanes, you know, out at O'Hare.
Right.
You know, and you've got a United Airlines plane right next door and they have to pay the people. Why should Air France, you know, be able to not pay? You know, they're engaged in commercial activity, clearly, even though they're owned by the government of France. And a court has a need to be able to manage proceedings before it. And one of the tools, one of the essential tools for a court, is the possibility of contempt at any point in the way. And the rule you're arguing for suggests that foreign sovereigns are free of that. The court actually isn't able to manage the litigation before it, notwithstanding the fact that an exception to immunity applies, notwithstanding the fact that it's going to be liable.
Your Honor, I think the answer to your question probably has at least three parts. The first is that we know from United States v. Horn that sovereign immunity can trump inherent judicial authority to do something. The second answer is that the jurisdiction of the federal courts is limited. It comes from Congress, and the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is speaking to the ability of the courts to do something. And the third answer is that the
if you can find, I mean, unfortunately, there's no provision, there's no 1606A that says, oh, and by the way, the federal courts have no contempt power, no monetary. I mean, if there were, I think you would have an ironclad argument. You wouldn't be here, probably. You would have settled. But since there isn't, you know, we have to decide, is this somehow implicit in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, don't we?
The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was put up against a pre-existing rule of absolute immunity. So unless there's an exception in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that absolute immunity remains. What we know from international law, and we know from practice, and we know even from the ability of domestic courts to regulate interactions with the sovereign, all we're saying is you can't impose monetary contempt sanctions. You can impose injunctive relief. You can dismiss claims. You can do other things within the court's power. The one thing you can't do is impose monetary contempt sanctions. For example, in the UN Convention on Immunities, which has been adopted by the International Law Commission and approved by the General Assembly of the United Nations, it says that courts cannot impose monetary contempt sanctions on sovereigns.
Right, but the United States is not yet a party to that, right?
That's correct.
Just because I don't want you to run out of time, I would like to spend a minute on the 1610 argument, because
yes,
it seems to me that at least must be properly before us, since
yes,
it's only in February of 2006 that the court reduces this long-running $5,000 a day to suddenly this $18 million and some judgment. So as I understand your opponent's argument, it is we need to take step one first before we can take any other steps. And step one is to reduce that contempt sanction to a judgment, then, in a sense, it's our problem whether we're going to collect on that judgment from assets in the United States, which would trigger a 1610-like procedure, or if we want to go overseas and try to collect on that judgment, which I'll say editorially, since I'm not an overseas judge, I think is a very optimistic thought on their part. But in any event, what's wrong with the district courts reducing this judgment to a money sum, and is the 1610 issue even ripe before us at this point?
The 1610 issue is absolutely ripe because we timely took an appeal from the writ of execution, and that didn't exist before, and it exists now. And it's a clear violation of the sovereign immunity of Integral as an agency or instrumentality. We know from the AFCAP decision that recently came down from the Ninth Circuit that the provisions of 1610 are actually jurisdictional. So under any theory, it's properly before the court. But in any case, 1610 has essentially three or four requirements. First, a court, and 1610C is very clear, a court has to make a determination that the property belongs to Integral, that the property is in the United States, that Integral is not immune for some sort of underlying conduct, and that regardless of anything else, the property is not absolutely immune under the provisions of 1611 of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Just by way of example, one of the things that exists in 1611 is a determination that the property doesn't have a military character. Well, Integral does military contracts. I'm not suggesting that there are any assets in the United States, and I'm not suggesting that there are any military property in the United States, but it's a perfect example of why a court needs to make this determination.
And so you're just saying that the district court order in this respect is incomplete, that the district court didn't go through and make the findings that 1610 requires.
That's correct.
Requires, which would lead to a remand.
Yes.
Okay.
But because the case is properly here, the court has the obligation to consider all matters of subject matter jurisdiction. In addition, I see that I'm running close on time.
Your rebuttal time.
I'll just simply add that in AMCAST, this court said that in matters involving comity, and comity has been defined as the international version of the Golden Rule, this court also has the ability to reach back and look at things that weren't presented before on appeal. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Fleischer.
Thank you. I had written out some comments, but I would like to address some of the things that Your Honor has asked the opposing counsel. In their brief, in the appellant's brief, they stated at page 15, monetary contempt sanctions against a sovereign entity, although technically not forbidden. I don't understand what technically not forbidden means. It is not forbidden. There's nothing in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that forbids monetary contempt sanctions. There's nothing in the case law that forbids it. And in fact, a fair reading of the entire Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is that in cases like this, we're dealing with governments, whether it be Belarus or China, where American companies are dealing with hundreds of Chinese companies that are corporations that happen to be owned by the Chinese government. There's lawsuits going on. There's people buying goods. The federal courts here have jurisdiction to decide those lawsuits when these corporations that are instrumentalities of a foreign government are dealing in commercial activity.
There's no question about that, Mr. Fleischer, and I think we need to be clear about the difference between the underlying lawsuit, which as far as I can tell falls absolutely squarely inside the commercial activities exception of 1605A, and the issues here, because part of our question is, under the structure of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, do we need to look for something that permits monetary contempt sanctions, or do we need to look at something that forbids it? Because we start out with 1604, which establishes the general rule of immunity of a foreign state. And then, as you've correctly pointed out in your brief, you have 1606 that says, you know, once you get over the, you know, once you find something under 1605, more or less, that allows the suit to go forward, the foreign state shall be liable in the same manner, which I think one could read to say, you know, you have to pay the tort damages, you have to pay the contract damages, you have to, you know, reimburse the foreign investor, whatever it is that the suit is about. But it doesn't say anything, but it, actually then it goes on to say, but a foreign state, except for an agency or instrumentality, shall not be liable for punitive damages. Okay, so there's a specific rule about punitive damages. What I don't see is anything about contempt sanctions. And so in the absence of permission, just as we have affirmative permission for punitive damages, why don't we default back to the underlying rule of immunity of 1604?
Because if you look under, one of the interesting things is under 1605A2, which is the commercial activity, it's not a waiver. It doesn't provide...
I didn't say it was a waiver. It's an exception.
It says there is no sovereign immunity.
Of course, but that's for the contract damages. That's for the amount of money you lost because they were selling the wrong way. It doesn't say anything about contempt.
Well, I would propose that it's saying that in the case that's dealing with that commercial activity, which here is dealing with the rights to sell in the United States, that once there's no sovereign immunity, the agency who can be liable, the instrumentality, who can be liable for punitive damages, proceeds like any other private party.
But it doesn't, because we know from 1610, for example, that there is a set of cases against instrumentalities, and the foreign sovereign is still entitled, and meaning both the foreign sovereign, agencies or instrumentalities, et cetera, anything that falls within the definition of a foreign sovereign, it's still entitled to some, if you will, extra benefits under this statute that ordinary litigants don't get, extra rules about which assets are liable on attachment, special rules for service of process, and the like. And the Supreme Court, in the Dole Foods against Patrickson case, decides to draw the line as to who gets to, you know, remember that's the case about stacking sovereign immunity. So they draw the line at the first wholly owned subsidiary, like Integral. So if Integral wholly owns somebody, they wouldn't be entitled to these extra perks. So you don't just turn into an ordinary litigant the minute you find a 1605A exception.
I'm sorry, Jess. Okay. If 1610 wasn't there, the reason why you don't turn into an ordinary litigant is because we have 1610. If you didn't have 1610, 1606 says you're an ordinary litigant. 1610 is exceptions and provides
for
exceptions for...
Well, and so is 1608, and so is...
Right, but there is no exception regarding contempt. And as Your Honor said, and I would propose, it makes no sense whatsoever to say an instrumentality of a foreign state can litigate here, can ignore discovery orders. Court has no... Like in this case... They appeared, they had a lawyer, the court entered an order compelling discovery. Their concept is, you can't fine us, you can't do that. There's nothing in the law that says that. It doesn't make any sense, but what's even more so is, Integral, a corporation, entered into an injunction. That it wasn't like in the case that they cite, the new case where the court entered something, they said to the court, we want an injunction, and we want the court to enter an order that Autotech pays us $417,000, and we want the court to enter an order that we will not compete here in the United States except through Autotech. Once they do that, they have waived. That's a sovereign immunity waiver.
Well,
right
again,
there.
That's and again, you're still in the underlying case. I'm trying to look at this stage of things, and I'll tell you, there's an irony here, because if at the time you had the contract complaint against them, which was that they weren't living up to their obligation as to where they were supposed, at least allegedly, where they were supposed to be, through whom they were supposed to be distributing these things. If you got a default judgment in a regular old contract action, courts of many other countries recognize and enforce actions for contractual damages. You wouldn't, it'd be a very ordinary case. I mean, some courts look at the underlying facts again. Other courts will give you presumptions. The rules vary around the world. And you'd have a fairly straightforward thing, whereas courts in other countries almost uniformly refuse to recognize and enforce anything that smacks of a punitive award, including, I would say, contempt sanctions. That's your problem for later down the line, but you had a very easy and effective remedy that you could have engaged in, namely enforce that discovery order through the Rule 37 sanctions that are available, which include default judgment. Why not?
Well, once the discovery order was entered, Your Honor, we went ahead and proceeded with discovery. They came to court. They complied with the court order.
All right. Well, I'm just saying as an example, the court has the power to remedy disregard of its process with a default judgment.
But when the party integral who has said to the court, to the American court, said, I'm filing a $118 million suit here against Auditech, and I'm defending Auditech's case, and I'm submitting to subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction.
You're back on the original case still.
Let me go to, once the injunction is entered, and they consent to the injunction, at that point in time, if they violate that injunction, that's commercial activity. The violation is commercial activity, which the statute clearly says, if you're involved in commercial activity, don't come in and try to claim you're a sovereign.
They're not doing that, though. I think what they're saying is before you can execute on this contempt judgment, this $18 million contempt judgment, which has nothing to do with how many semiconductors were sold, you need to go through certain procedures. You need to follow the 1610 procedures, identify the assets in the United States that you think you're going to go after, negate various other things. There is this little checklist of things, none of which happens. These district court transcripts are about a page and a half long where people kind of randomly decide whether they want $20,000 a day or five.
Well,
None of this happens.
I agree with what the court said as to 1610. It's not ripe because we haven't gone after any assets in the United States. 1610 is dealing with assets in the United States. We have said, and Your Honor, I think, found that the reason why we're getting this judgment is to go after assets overseas. 1610 has nothing to do with anything getting assets overseas. It specifically says when you're trying to go after assets in the United States. It's premature and not ripe to say that we're going after certain assets that we're not allowed to do when we haven't gone after anything.
But you know, the Supreme Court has said in a case called EEOC against Aramco that there's a presumption that United States laws, and here I would include court proceedings, are not extraterritorial in their scope. And if you're really saying that the only reason you want this judgment is so that you can go to some other country, why don't you go to the courts of that country?
No, Your Honor, I'm talking about the execution. There's two orders. One is the execution, the writ of execution, which is dealt with in 1610. The other is the judgment. The judgment is the order that just quantifies.
And this is a punitive judgment.
Well, it's not punitive.
Well, yes, it is. It doesn't have to do with how many things were sold.
Well, the reason why
it was. It's not based on sales quantities at all.
There's two types of contempt, civil and criminal. As they said in their brief, they assume this is civil. I assume it's civil also because we're trying to get what Judge Kaur was trying to get was compliance and redress for damages.
But there's no proof of damages, and civil contempt can't go on for 9 years for compliance purposes.
Well, the only reason it went on for 9 years, again, as Your Honor pointed out before, is that although Integral, while they say they weren't properly served, they very carefully make no statement that they didn't know about this case.
Well, they weren't properly served. I mean,
they knew about this for nine years.
They had actual notice.
They certainly did have actual notice. For nine years, they did nothing.
And in fact,
but if service was necessary as opposed to actual notice, then actual notice doesn't matter. We have lots of cases that say that for the beginnings of lawsuits, too. You can have all the actual notice in the world, and if you weren't properly served, you still don't have to respond.
But as Your Honor pointed out, and no one has cited any cases that say that if you don't comply with the local rule, that it's void and we have a right to ignore the contempt, and there isn't such a case that says that. In addition, Your Honor, I'd like to point out one thing, and that's when we talk about what counsel said, you have jurisdiction over the 1610 issue. Remember that we gave notice that we're going into before Judge Kaur on the 1610 issue, getting a judgment and getting an execution. No one
but
appeared.
But you didn't follow any rules for giving notice to the foreign sovereign.
We sent notice that the court may say is not an appropriate notice.
See, the problem is with this area, it's why I'm kind of interested in what the State Department thinks about it. The U.S. embassies all over the world don't want to become, probably, repositories of every notice that's sent to somebody with an affiliation with the American government. And these things are all reciprocal.
And I just wanted, as I was saying, this is unusual because they're appealing from a district court judgment that they didn't appear and don't explain why they don't appear. They never argue that the court shouldn't go ahead. They make that argument first.
Why did you select the method of service that you did? They were represented by counsel, weren't they?
Well, as I state in two different sections in my brief, briefs, the prior to the us going in on a, first of all, the counsel represented them up through the judgment. We got a judgment, we got an order, the case was then over, and the case was finished. Post-judgment, we came in on a motion for contempt.
Well, yes, but there continued to be jurisdiction, the court so put in its order, right?
Correct. The court had continuing jurisdiction, but we were dealing with the lawyer, Mr. Lapine, who was coming in and out of the case on an ongoing basis. We had just, as I pointed out in our motion for contempt, we had just met with the ambassador who said, contact us, we will assist you as you, because we want to get compliance and we want to get this order done. The record in Exhibit 5 and 7 to the complaint shows this is a 10 million square foot company with 42,000 employees. It's not a small company, it's a major company, and we were dealing directly with the ambassador, and there's also a minister.
Well, that goes back to my earlier question, how detailed was the ambassador involved? Is he like an agent for the corporation?
The statements that are made are that the ambassador was dealing with negotiating for Integral, and we were dealing directly with the ambassador in addition to people out of town, because there was never
any
hearing.
Why is there no proof of service filed in this record? Why do we only have this kind of comment?
Because of the 9 years ago, I've tried to go back and try to figure out exactly what we have in the record and what we don't have in the record, and I don't know that. It is clear that I, that's me, had the proof of service here, and I said that Integral has been served with the rule to show cause on December 12th.
I know you represented that. Certainly I'm not accusing you of not being straightforward with the court, but there usually you have a proof of service filed.
Well, this would be a certified mail.
Whatever it is. I mean, it's filed.
Well, here what we did is we put in the court order that the Integral was, there was service on December 12th, and that's what the court order says. That was entered by Judge Kaur. Judge Kaur had been the person policing this case all the way along.
But when there's a question about whether the service was adequate, one would learn something by looking at that proof of service. If it had the ambassador's name on it, that would be one thing. If it had the lawyer's name on it, it would be another thing. If it had the name of the CEO of Integral, that would be a third thing.
One of the interesting hindsight we can look back, but throughout the history of this case, Integral never claimed any sovereign immunity and was dealing directly with the American courts through ministers, through the ambassador, and there wasn't an issue regarding this at that point in time.
I even
addressed in our motion for execution, you might have seen, that after the order was entered, we sat down and tried to settle this. And that's 1998 we're talking about. And I state that in the motion for execution. Tried to settle it, couldn't settle it, and Integral still made no motion to vacate the order. So the argument that counsel made that this isn't the law of the case is missing the point. They don't appeal from the 1997 order. It's not in the notice of appeal. It's not an appeal from that. So that order is going to remain. The contempt order remains.
Can I ask you, this is a random question, but there was this perpetual distribution agreement, seemingly, between Integral and Autotech. I assume, although you can correct me if I'm wrong, that in light of all this, all these events, Autotech today is not distributing any Integral products?
Today they are not. But
what point did they stop?
Well, I know it continued during 1998 and into 1999. I don't know at what point they exactly stopped, but continued for, there was lots of communication between the parties for over a year going on. As long as Your Honor's asking, I mean, I had dinner with the ambassador and sat down and we talked. It's very unusual for an ambassador to come out and deal with a contract, but we had threatened them that we were going in, and I sent the letter, we were going in for an injunction that would stop them from selling here in the United States.
What kind of record was made in the district court concerning actual knowledge and so forth? Was there in it, was there, you, apart from you making those representations?
Apart from my representations, which were done in the motion for execution, there wasn't any other record made in the court. When I say record, I mean transcript record. We did appear before Judge Kaur on December 9th when I went in on the motion for contempt. We did have conversations, and Judge Kaur had known about this case, so we talked about the case on that day. Evidently, there's not a record of it because there's no transcript that appears here in the here. But I did have a – there were conversations between the judge and I regarding the case. And, of course, it was the judge who ordered on December 23rd that after giving the original motion, the rule of show cause, which was served on integral, and then he was entering the contempt, he said, let's give one more try. And he said, send to the ambassador. Not that it's a technical service, but because you don't need it after that. But he said, send to the ambassador. Fax over there and send notice of this before I enter this order. I'll give him one more chance. There was no service needed at that point in time, but he said to do that. That was done. The record shows it was done, and again, nothing happened. Even in December of 2005, when we sent letters to, which are in the record, to Integral, it was, they were ignored.
In this conversation you alluded to that you had with the ambassador, there was no affidavit or anything filed relating to that, or no affidavits filed, period, right?
Nothing other than the fact that in our motion, I do recite that, and of course, there's no one's ever contradicted it, put it that way. I do want to state that the one case that counsel's relying upon, the AFCAP case, which is the Fifth Circuit case, the new 2006 case, is a case where the court found no commercial activity. Once they found no commercial activity, the court said that there is no immunity under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. Once they found no immunity under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, they said that you can't do, wait, they said there is immunity,
is immunity.
And then they said you can't do contempt. That's in keeping with the quote that's in the papers where Congress, when they were doing this, said that it may be that where there is immunity, you can't get monetary sanctions. But that quote that's in the briefs does say where there is immunity. It doesn't say that in these cases you can't get it. It says where there's immunity, meaning there's no commercial activity. And we're also dealing, remember, we're dealing with a corporation, Integral Research and Production Corporation, that happens to be owned by the federal government, and our courts need to be able to enforce agreements with companies that we're doing business with overseas just like this.
Thank you, Mr. Fleischer. Mr. Barron, you have 2 minutes, Mr. Barron.
Putting aside for a moment the international issues, it is clear law in the Seventh Circuit that an ambiguous injunction cannot be enforced. The federal agreed order in 1997 makes reference to two extrinsic documents, one of which Autotech concedes in its response brief does not even exist. Under the law of D. Patrick, if you cannot read the injunction, you cannot enforce it. We don't know whether or not the injunction that was issued in 1997 was compensatory or whether or not it was coercive. If it was coercive, or criminally, if it was coercive, somewhere along the way, the court needs to make a determination as to whether or not that sanction has become criminally punitive, because the court has an underlying supervisory authority and obligation to monitor and watch what's going on in that contempt order. And
but of course, you never asked it to. I mean, you're saying essentially when the final proceedings began that led to this $18 million judgment, the judge sua sponte should have made that inquiry?
The judge has an obligation to make sure that his judgment doesn't become criminally punitive, or at some point he needs to consider the United Mine Workers factors as to whether or not this actually is a coercive judgment. The court never did any of those things, not in 1997, not in 2006. As a consequence, the order cannot stand and needs to be vacated. Finally, it is well-established law that the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act can create rights without remedies. All we're saying here is that certain remedies were not available, the remedy of monetary contempt sanction. They could have got a finding of contempt. They could have taken that to the State Department. The State Department could have espoused their claim. There were a lot of things that could have happened in this case, but that, frankly, did not. As a consequence, the 2006 orders should be vacated. I see that my time is up. The 2006 order should be vacated, and to the extent that the court considers that it's necessary, remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.